Grace and peace, everybody. It's great to be with you. It's we have such a deep bench of people that the frequency of at least my speaking has gone down quite a bit, and so it's been slower to get through some of the books of the Bible here that I've been hoping to work through. But that's all right. It's a great problem to have. I don't know about you, but I am often upset at the world today. I have to watch myself in terms of reading the news because I can get so worked up that I can easily spend a couple of hours reading stories that just really make me have this sense of indignation at what the world is facing today. I was born in the 70s, I grew up in the 80s, and I feel like growing up in the 90, in the 80s, rather, the world just feels a lot more disturbing in some way. Some of you I pray with on Tuesday mornings, there's a group of us, we pray together, and those who are in that prayer meeting know that I often will pray about what's going on in Ukraine. I just can't believe still that this is going on, watching tens of thousands of people having died in the prime of their life. And what especially gets me is that the Russian forces, they claim to be Orthodox Christians. And we know that the patriarch of the Russian Orthodox Church, his name is Michael Kirill, he's openly endorsed this. He's given out icons of the Virgin Mary to various leaders here. He said it's a holy war that's correct and just. The leader of the largest see, the largest group in Orthodoxy, has blatantly endorsed violence. So you have that on one side, and then, of course, Trump said he would end it all within one day of taking office. Here we are, many days after. You see all these things going on in the world, and it's very upsetting. I see so many leaders of governments call themselves Christians and then yet do terrible things. I feel upset about this, and I can't imagine what it's like if I were living on the ground there, seeing all these things happen day by day, watching friends, family be killed, be raped, have your lives just completely destroyed. There was one statistic that someone published which said that before the invasion, 15% of Ukrainians felt anger, hatred, or contempt towards Russia and its citizens. Now it's 76%. So it's gone from 15 to 76, which I can understand that. What would you do if you were talking to somebody who was in that 76% who said, I am so angry, I have so much hatred for the loss of life and the destruction? How would you counsel that person? Now, I know for myself, good things rarely, and I think this is true for everybody, but good things rarely come out of these very emotional states where you're angry, especially when you're wanting to like punish evil or somehow deal with evil. There's a famous story that I want to read before getting into Matthew here. It's from Luke chapter 9. It's verses 51 to 56. If you have a Bible, you can turn to it. I'm going to read it from the New King James. It's actually quite different in the majority text as it is in the Alexandrian text. So I'll read from the New King James because that captures the majority text. It says, "Now it came to pass, when the time had come for him to be received up, that he," talking about Jesus, "steadfastly set his face to go to Jerusalem and sent messengers before his face. And as they went, they entered a village of the Samaritans to prepare for him. But they did not receive him because his face was set for the journey to Jerusalem. And when his disciples James and John saw this, they said, 'Lord, do you want us to command fire to come down from heaven and consume them, just as Elijah did?' But he turned and rebuked them and said, 'You do not know what manner of spirit you are of. For the Son of Man did not come to destroy men's lives, but to save them.'" Now, I admit, I can identify with James and John in this passage. I think I probably would have been right with them. I'm a person who kind of like tends to run hot when I see things that I am upset by, and I think my impulse would have been the same. Time to destroy all these unbelievers. Time to leverage some of that power that you have. It just seems so fitting. It seems so right, naturally speaking. But of course, Jesus rebukes James and John and says, you don't know what's even inside you. You don't know what manner of spirit you are of. That's kind of a scary line, isn't it? Saying that you don't even understand what's really inside of yourself. And somehow he's saying that, like, if you understood, you would repent. You would turn away from this, because if you're on my team, then you're not about destroying people's lives. You're about saving them. Jesus somehow works with zealots and turns their zeal towards trust and to love. Humans have constantly faced this temptation to seek punishment, to root out the unfaithful, and it hasn't gone well. Think about the Crusades. Think about how that went. Think about the Inquisitions. These are some of the times in history where people said, it's time to take matters into our own hands. It's time to deal with evil. Perhaps even in your own life, think about, maybe not a big historic event, but think about times in your life where you have seen destruction, pain among people that you love, yourself. How do you respond? Is your instinct more in the James and John side? And again, I would say for myself, that's often been where I have been. Think about some of the people that you've had issues with. Perhaps you have resentment or bitterness, or even just a simple desire for justice. How can we process this? How can we take these human emotions and deal with them in a healthy way? So to answer this, we're going to go to the book of Matthew. So for those who don't know, I've been, over the last several years, been working through the book of Matthew. We're in Matthew chapter 13. So if you can turn to Matthew 13, we're going to read verses 24 to 43. Matthew 13, verses 24 to 43. Another parable he put forth to them, saying, the kingdom of heaven is like a man who sowed good seed in his field. But while men slept, his enemy came and sowed tares among the wheat and went his way. But when the grain had sprouted and produced a crop, then the tares also appeared. So the servants of the owner came and said to him, sir, did you not sow good seed in your field? How then does it have tares? He said to them, an enemy has done this. The servant said to him, do you want us then to go and gather them up? But he said, no, lest while you gather them up, when you gather up the tares, you also uproot the wheat with them. Let both grow together until the harvest, and at the time of harvest, I will say to the reapers, first, gather together the tares and bind them in bundles to burn them, but gather the wheat into my barn. Another parable he put forth to them, saying, the kingdom of heaven is like mustard seed, which a man took and sowed in his field, which indeed is the least of all the seeds, but when it is grown is greater than the herbs and becomes a tree, so that the birds of the air come and nest in its branches. Another parable he spoke to them, the kingdom of heaven is like leaven, which a woman took and hid in three measures of meal till all was leavened. All these things Jesus spoke to the multitude in parables, and without a parable he did not speak to them, that it might be fulfilled which was spoken by the prophet, saying, I will open my mouth in parables. I will utter things kept secret from the foundation of the world. Then Jesus sent the multitude away and went into the house. And his disciples came to him, saying, explain to us the parable of the tares of the field. He answered and said to them, he who sows the good seed is the Son of Man. The field is the world. The good seeds are the sons of the kingdom, but the tares are the sons of the wicked one. The enemy who sowed them is the devil. The harvest, the end of the age, and the reapers are the angels. Therefore, as the tares are gathered and burned in the fire, so it will be at the end of this age. The Son of Man will send out his angels, and they will gather out of his kingdom all things that offend and those who practice lawlessness, and will cast them into the furnace of fire. There will be wailing and gnashing of teeth. Then the righteous will shine forth as the sun in the kingdom of their Father. He who has ears to hear, let him hear. Okay, let's pray. Father in heaven, as we face the specter of injustice in all different facets of life, at these global dimensions where we see war and suffering and poverty and rape and killing, it is just heartbreaking. As we see it even in perhaps smaller ways in our own lives, it is no less concerning. We see indeed that we are in a very fallen world, and we need you to redeem our minds and our hearts so that we can respond in godly ways. Thank you that Jesus has anticipated this, and he, as our faithful King and Shepherd, is showing us the way in this passage. And so I just pray a blessing on your word as it goes forth, that we would have settled hearts to hear what Jesus is speaking. Pray these things in his name. Amen. Okay, so let's review where we are, especially because, as I said, it's been a while. So Matthew is, of course, organized around five speeches, and this is portraying Matthew as this new Moses-like figure. Moses has five books, the Torah, the first five books of the Bible, and Jesus has his five speeches here. The first one is, of course, the most famous Sermon on the Mount. What's the second one? Probably the least well-known, unfortunately, but it's in Matthew 10. Anybody remember that one? Yeah, it has several names. That's one. So there's probably like three or four names that you'll hear. It's either called the Sermon of Commissioning, the Sermon on Evangelism, the Sermon on Witnessing, the Sermon on Mission. Basically, he launches his apostles, his disciples out to preach the gospel. And in that sermon in Matthew 10, he says, I'm going to send you out, and guess what? You're going to face persecution. It's going to be very difficult. You're going to be betrayed by those people who are closest to you. Guess what happens just a few verses later? It's near the beginning of Matthew chapter 11. John the Baptist is in prison. Well, that should be no surprise. Why? Because Jesus has said that his followers are going to be suffering persecution. In the very next chapter, in Matthew 12, the Pharisees decide that they're going to kill Jesus. This should also be no surprise, because the way that Matthew has designed his book is you first hear a teaching, and then you see it lived out. And so we talked about this way back when with the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5 through 7, and then the Sermon on the Move, Matthew 8 through 9, and we get to see the Sermon on the Mount played out. All those sermons are online if you missed those. Matthew 10, we see the sermon on witnessing or evangelism or mission, and then we see that play out over the next two chapters. Now, after that discourse and then that narrative, we come to chapter 13. And I think the disciples, it's very reasonable, they would be thinking, okay, we've got some persecution, but hey, we're on Team Messiah, right? We're going to win, and we're on the right team, and this is going to last for a while, but eventually we're going to get to see some Roman heads roll. We're going to win. We're going to triumph. We just have to hang on for this season. So that is what the context is for Matthew 13. It's all this persecution. They must have been starting to question, starting to wonder. John the Baptist himself was wondering what was going on. And so we come to Matthew 13, which is the center of the five speeches, right? So number three is in the middle. And it has, so beautiful, seven parables in Matthew 13. It's very carefully constructed, very, very carefully written. The first parable, what's the first parable in Matthew 13? We spent 2 weeks looking at this one. The parable of the sower. This is probably one of the most famous, if not the most famous, parable of Jesus. And the bottom line message from that was that not everybody is going to hear Jesus' message and believe and be faithful. So you can already tell he's tempering the disciples' expectations, right? Again, they must be thinking like, hey, we're going to win, we're going to win. And Jesus says in Matthew 13, in the parable of the sower, he says, wait a minute. Just so you know, there's four soils, four general types of soil here. And we'll just quickly go over this just to refresh everybody's memory. The first soil I called the soil of apathy. It's seeds that fall on the path. And I read this quote to you a couple months ago now. In contrast to a field, a footpath, a place where people walk, is a soil whose main task is not receiving seed, but receiving feet. This soil is unfruitful because its orientation is wrong. It receives the activity of people and not the activity of the sower as its main occupation. And so that seed, which is very concerned about what are people going to think and is concerned about pleasing people, it just gets plucked away. The second soil is shallow ground, and that category of people can't handle difficulty or conflict or tribulation, and they die. The third soil I called the soil of divided loyalty. Do you remember how we talked about here how there are these thorns, and these thorns, they choke out the word, and it eventually dies as well. Only one of the four soils becomes fruitful. And that soil is the soil of those who hear and do the word of God joyfully. So Jesus is preparing his disciples. He's saying, okay, just so you know, a lot of people are going to hear, and they're going to even look promising. It's going to seem exciting, but they're actually going to falter. Don't make it. They're not going to make it, so just be prepared. And Jesus is signaling as well that as the Son of Man, he's very generous in spreading soil to even people who are unlovable and unlikely. Okay, so now that takes us to today's passage, which is parables 2-4. So I told you there's seven parables. These are parables 2-4, and they form a unit, as we'll see. This second parable starts with this expression. Hopefully you can all see it in verse 24. Most translations say the kingdom of heaven is like. You see that? That is used six times in this chapter. It's used in verse 31, or 24, 31, 33, 44, 45, and 47. So six plus the parable of the sower, that gives you seven. Now, I'll just slightly challenge the translations here. The kingdom of heaven is not a great translation. The verb is actually an aorist passive. It really should be something like the kingdom of heaven has become. That would be a more accurate way of capturing this. The kingdom of heaven is now launched. It is on the move, and it's become this reality. It gives a different flavor, doesn't it? The kingdom of heaven has become like, and then the rest of it goes on. I'll also point out one little detail, which is very easy to miss. But in verse 24, depending on translation, it says something like Jesus sets before the people this parable. And that word sets before is not used very often. It is used, however, in Exodus 19:7 in the Septuagint, where Moses is going to lay out the Old Covenant. It's also used in Deuteronomy 4:44. It's used kind of at the beginning of really big, important speeches. And so sometimes it's easy to take the parables and treat them as these like throwaways or maybe as lesser than something like the Sermon on the Mount. But it's signaling here that this is very formal, lofty, important speech. Okay, so the second parable, which is about the wheat and the tares, is the longest in this cluster of parables 2-4. And we're going to be focusing on that one today. Hopefully, we first notice that it has some things in common with the parable of the sower. What are some things that it has in common?
There's a sower.
Yeah, there's a sower, exactly. So there's somebody who's planting seed in both the first parable of sower, and this one. Good, Phoenix.
There's a field.
Yeah, there's a field again. So there's very agrarian images here. Yeah, there's an antagonist. Very good. There's an antagonist here as well, just like there was in the parable of sower. Excellent. So there's connections here. And in verse 25, there's an enemy who comes and he sows tares. Now, this is a word that we like never use in regular English, at least in modern English, tares. Actually, I have here a picture. The tare is something that is, here we go, is a plant that looks a lot like wheat when the plant is young, but when the plant matures, you realize it's a counterfeit. Hopefully this works. Okay, good. So here we have on this something that's wheat and something that's a counterfeit of wheat. This is an actual picture of the plant. Almost everybody believes the plant is called darnel. And it's not so easy, right, to tell the difference between the two. And in fact, if you look here, this is the real label here. So darnel is on the left, wheat is on the right. And you can't even really tell until the final stages. At the earlier stages, they look almost identical. So not so easy to tell. In fact, the enemy here is almost certainly another farmer who's competing with this farmer. So I looked this up. I spent some time looking into this. It was such a problem that Rome actually had laws against farmers doing this. So why would a farmer want to do this? Well, you can imagine if you're a farmer and you're selling wheat, if your other competing farmers have a lot of weeds, well, they're going to have less supply. And if there's less supply, the price will be higher, so you're going to make more money. And so they actually had laws on the books to condemn and to punish farmers who would do exactly this, who would like throw this darnel seed onto other people's fields. So a real problem, so people would have been able to connect with this. And so as the plants mature and they finally see, it's like, oh wow, this isn't in fact real wheat at all. We've got a problem on our hands, landowner. What are we going to do? They say, should we just try to like uproot one by one each of these? And you can imagine that's one not very easy to do because the root systems are going to be intertwined and that's going to cause a lot of problems and you're going to hurt the wheat that you want. And so the farmer says, just wait. We're going to let it all grow up until the very end when we can finally deal with the tares. We'll come to the interpretation in a little bit. So after this, Jesus tells two very short parables about a mustard seed, and then that mustard seed is very small, and it's famous for being small. It's sort of renowned for how little it is, but it becomes a large tree. And here, it seems like the message is very simple. The message is like, hey, the kingdom of God is small and unassuming. It doesn't have this like bang spectacular entry. I think that's what people were wanting. They were hoping for something like what they would have had in the Maccabean era, where the Maccabeans, they came in and heads were rolling, right? This was a very powerful, dramatic moment where they threw off the leadership at that time in order to kind of reinstall a more pure Judaism here. And in the parable of the mustard seed, Jesus is saying it's small, it's quiet, it's unassuming. We all know, even if you're not a farmer, that when you grow a plant, it's not the most exciting thing, is it? It's just sort of slow, and it grows and grows. And after time, it can become big, but there's no da-da-da-da moment where it just happens. So nothing spectacular here. And again, he's trying to temper what the disciples are actually hoping for being on Team Messiah. The second short parable is about leaven. And leaven is the same thing as yeast, and it works its way through three measures of flour. And same thing, right? Yeast, when you put it into bread, it's very unassuming. It just happens without you really being able to visibly see it. And this is probably something that escapes our notice unless you have a footnote in your Bible. Three measures is the equivalent of 40 liters or 15 gallons. So this works out to be about 50 pounds of flour. And so the estimate is this amount could feed somewhere between 100 to 150 people. And so Jesus' point is that just a little bit of yeast can produce a banquet. It can feed a huge party of people, a large party. And so the interpretation of these two parables, I think, is quite straightforward. Don't disregard, don't underestimate what is small. I'm sure the disciples were thinking, who are we? We're just this tiny little group of people. We have no fame, no notoriety. This isn't going like we thought it was going to be. But Jesus is saying, what is small can accomplish great things. After these two little parables, we get another comment on parables. We had some instruction on parables earlier in Matthew 13. And if you look here, just at verse 34, it says, all these things Jesus spoke to the multitude in parables, and without a parable he did not speak to them, that it might be fulfilled which was spoken by the prophet, saying, I will open my mouth in parables, I will utter things kept secret from the foundation of the world. If you look up this citation, this is from Psalm 78, and Psalm 78 was written by Asaph. It's very interesting that Asaph is called a prophet, because if you know who Asaph is, hopefully some of you do, Asaph is a musician. He's mentioned in 1 Chronicles 25, 1-2. I gave a message on prophecy a while ago, and one of the key ideas of prophecy is that it's very closely bound up to worship. It's subject for a different message that's already online. So what's going on here? Matthew is really telling us that Jesus is now in this point where he's treating the crowds as outsiders. He's only speaking to them in parables, but that was prophesied in Psalm 78, and it's this kind of reminder here that there's this partitioning between the disciples and everybody else. It's a very good reminder these are parables. Now, I don't know how many of you have ever been bothered by this, but have you ever heard this? And people are kind of bothered because Jesus is using yeast or leaven as a picture of the kingdom. And yeast and leaven are used elsewhere as like sin and like something bad, right? And so people are like, whoa, what's going on here? Why is Jesus doing this? And even the mustard seed is not the most impressive tree. Like he could have said it will be like the cedars of Lebanon or a cypress or something like that. But the mustard seed is kind of the scraggly, bushy tree here. So why does he do this? Why does Jesus use a picture that's sometimes associated with sin, and he doesn't use a very impressive plant image before? And the answer is in keeping with what I talked about before. It's a lot like how Jesus likens himself to a thief in the night. And you're like, Jesus, a thief in the night? Like, that's illegal. Like, why do you make an analogy between you and a thief? Well, of course, the analogy, this is because parables, they're supposed to have this jarring quality to them, and they're supposed to kind of shake you a little bit and make you uncomfortable, and they're supposed to make you think. And so many of Jesus' parables do this. The parable of the dishonest manager is another example, where he's using what he can in order to get us all out of our slumber, to make us think, to make us stop in our tracks and think. Okay, so finally, this happens, and then Jesus goes into a house, and his disciples come and ask him about the parables of the weeds and the field. And then this is where the gold happens. Okay, so I will say this so often with such robustness. If you are a person who you just hear and you go your way, you will miss the real treasures that are there. I've found this so many times in my life, is you should go out of your way to talk to somebody who's teaching or speak, or go get into that inner circle And that's where the riches are going to be found. Is there something to be had in just the general speeches? Sure. But there's something about the people who press in to these private encounters that they have with Jesus. That's where you really get the riches and the treasures. I'll read you a quote here from Dale Bruner. He says this, "When Jesus leaves a crowd and comes into a house and answers disciples' questions, it is usually a gospel writer's way of saying how privileged we are to be in the house of the church, for here we have access to the Lord's mind and interpretation." So we've seen this in other of Jesus' accounts where he'll step away and he'll go into some private place, and it's those people who go that extra mile. Okay, what's going on? Tell me more, Jesus. And the crowds don't do that. The crowds just hear generally and they move on. Pay attention to that. Okay, so now that I've set this all up, I just want to give us a few points from this passage for us to take home and to meditate on. Okay, so the first is the answer to anger, resentment, impatience, or zealotry is to wait until the last day when evil will be judged. Okay, now this is a hard answer for me, but it's what Jesus is telling us here. Okay, so he's giving us this picture of a harvest, and the harvest is obviously the picture of judgment. And we said from the parable of the sower, Jesus is saying there's this diversity of responses, right? Some people are going to be apathetic. Some people are going to have divided loyalty. Some people are going to be struggling when hard times come. There's lots of people are going to fall away. Diversity of responses. We know that. But here he's saying not only is there going to be a diversity of responses, but you have to wait a really long time. Okay, so it's like width and depth here of patience that you have to have. And so he's basically saying no zealotry called for. Don't take things into your own hands. Who is it who executes judgment in this? Jesus explains it in the interpretation. Yeah, the angels. The angels are described as the reapers. They're the ones who bind up all of these tares, and they're the ones who send it to be burned. It's not James, it's not John, it's none of the disciples. None of them get to be the reapers. And this is really hard. I think this would be really hard for them. There's going to be this long delay that Jesus anticipates when judgment will come. Now, again, I actually think that we have it easy in the United States. We live in a generally peaceful country, a generally prosperous country. But imagine living in an environment where you are immersed in injustice. We know that's what it was like for the first century Israelites. Imagine today if you're a bricklayer in Pakistan, horrible life that you have. Imagine if you are in Ukraine, say, and you have to see this like endless cycle of murder and rape and destruction. It's not so easy to call for patience here. It's easier to call for, who's with me? Let's go get them. Yeah, let's go. But Jesus is saying, this is the job of the angels. It's not your job. We learn from this parable that Jesus believed that good and evil will coexist until the end of the age. Therefore, we have to be patient. We are supposed to live side by side with unbelievers until the very end. There have been so many in church history of these impulses to like, let's just gather all the Christians together in one place and let's kind of form our own little like holy huddle and everybody kind of like make our own little zone where it's just us. And Jesus is saying, no, that's not right. We're supposed to be side by side in this world of good and evil coexisting. This is a complete side note on the apologetics side, but I'll just say this for those who are interested in apologetics. There are so many people out there who say that Jesus thought that the end of the world would happen in his day, and that when he's on the cross and he says, my God, why have you forsaken me, that he's disappointed that it didn't play out like he thought. They don't read parables like this and see that, in fact, Jesus is telling us there's going to be a long time of good being side by side with evil. When we see injustice, you are going to be tempted to want to take matters into your own hands, to execute vengeance or justice. And this parable is a rebuke to that impulse, as it says, trust God, the judgment will happen. Wait until the end and let God deal with the problem of evil. You know, one of the main solutions that people offer to the problem of evil is free will. And I actually agree with that. I think that is a major answer to it. But not a lot of people put enough stress on the last day as the solution to the problem of evil. They're using too narrow of an aperture. If you widen out and look at the whole sweep of history, we would see that evil will be judged. And the problem of evil has a solution, but it's in God's hands. Who are the people who are judged? In verse 41, look at this verse. This is such an important verse. I hope you see this. The Son of Man will send out his angels, and they will gather out of his kingdom. The New King James says, all things that offend and those who practice lawlessness, and will cast them into the furnace of fire. Okay, I would be remiss to not just talk about this briefly here. This is such an important word for Matthew. There's this first word that is used. Skandalon is the word. We get our word scandal from it. It's a hard word to translate. The verb form is used 13 times in the book of Matthew. It's a common word. It's the same word that's used when it says, if your right eye causes you to sin, or if your right eye like offends you or something like that, depending on your translation. It's basically anything that leads to evil, anything that causes evil. I remember one of my waking up moments. It was when I was a freshman in college. I grew up in an environment where there was a lot of television and movies and things like that. And I had this epiphany. I actually wrote an essay about this. It might even still be online somewhere. And this essay was all about how people should not patronize cable television. It's one of my like early essays that I wrote. And my grounds were, if you patronize cable television, you're like sending your money to all of these things like MTV and all these different things. And you're kind of promoting the cause of leading people down evil ways. And I made the case that even if you were completely innocent and you're just watching the news or something like that, you're still sort of like helping evil in some way, at least financially. And I still remember in my teenage years being very passionate about this. And I'm grateful for that, because I just had this like loathing for the things that would lead people astray. And even if it was like a dollar, I'm like, I don't want to patronize this. And we need to be thinking about what are the things that lead people to sin. That's the skandalon that is being referenced here. And what is Jesus saying here? All those things are going to be cast into the furnace of fire. And those who practice lawlessness. Now, most of you know me well enough to know that this is like a key word. I have a whole chapter about this in King Jesus Claims His Church. What's that? What's this word here that is meant when we talk about lawlessness? What's that? Yeah. Yeah, the antinomian heresy. So basically, this is what Jesus talks about in the Sermon on the Mount. I remember how he says, all these people are going to come to me saying, Lord, Lord, didn't we do all these things? And he says, get away from me, I never knew you, you antinomians. And it's basically partial obedience. It's people who kind of think that they're in, but they pick and choose what they want to obey. And here Jesus is saying that those kinds of people will be cast into the furnace of fire. Chilling passage. There are a lot of people out there who call themselves Christians, but they pick and choose what to believe. Oh yeah, I can believe this, but this passage over here, I'm going to sweep that under the rug. This is a deadly pattern of behavior. We are warned again and again and again about this in the book of Matthew. It's used. This is used in verse 21 as well of this chapter. Okay, so Jesus is going to thoroughly deal, and the angels are going to thoroughly deal with all of the evil, that which leads to evil. It's going to be a eye-opening, tremendous, scary day when this happens, and it is coming. Okay, my second point is that the Son of Man is portrayed here as sower, not reaper. Son of Man is portrayed as sower, not reaper. This is amazing. Okay, in verse 37, he who sows the good seed is the Son of Man. Okay, I just love that. The expectations were, was that Messiah would come and he would be a reaper, right? This is finally the time. Look, a lot of seed was sown. Think about all of the Old Testament. Think about Moses and all these prophets and all this truth that had been disseminated. And the understanding was that Messiah was going to come, and guess what Messiah is going to do? He's finally going to like gather in those faithful Torah people, and he's going to judge everybody else. And people thought that's what was going to happen. But here, the Son of Man is portrayed as being a sower. I find that to be so incredible that when everybody thought the day of reckoning would come, Jesus is saying, no, I'm going to try to save the world. I'm going to sow seed. God deserved a harvest. He definitely deserved a harvest. There's a famous parable that Jesus tells of this vineyard, and he has the landowner has like charged different people to take care of this field and to yield fruits. And he sends group after group to bring these fruits, right? Those are the prophets of the Old Testament. And finally he says, all right, they didn't believe all them, but I'm going to send my son. I'm going to give one final effort to get this harvest that I'm due. And of course, we know that the son of man, in the parable, that son is killed. So here, yet again, the Son of Man is portrayed as a sower, not a reaper. What a beautiful picture that is. My third point is that there is an enemy, and he is powerless to uproot you. Okay, so first of all, I love the way that this is explained. It has this sort of very powerful poetic quality to it. So do you see in verse 27? In verse 27, read this with me. So the servants of the owner came and said to him, sir, did you not sow good seed in your field? How then does it have tares? What are the servants doing? They're saying to this landowner, they're saying, you messed up. Like, didn't you do your job and plant good seed? And just a very simple response comes from the landowner. An enemy has done this. An enemy has done this. This is so important. The answer to the problem of evil is not that it was God's doing. There's a lot of people out there who will, in some manner, say, oh, it's God's sovereignty or this or that. No. An enemy has done this. In this way, God is exonerated from all this weed and all these problems there. You cannot explain the world biblically unless you give credence to the fact that there's another force, there's another enemy afoot. Of course, that's the devil. So there is an enemy. That's the answer to this problem of what's going on in this world. There is an enemy out there. But notice this, right? This is also just, it gives me so much encouragement. The enemy could have just gone and, like, you might think, just go and pluck the wheat up, right? But this enemy can't do that. He is powerless to pull up the wheat. Jesus has lots of places where he says, nobody can pluck me out of your hand. There is a security, there is a greatness that Jesus has where this wheat can't be touched by this enemy. So instead, the enemy can't pluck up the wheat, which is what probably his number one choice would be. So instead, what does the enemy do? He sows rival seed. He sows different seed. I showed you that picture earlier. And so we actually have a second sower. There's two sowers here, right? There's the landowner, the good sower, and then there's an enemy. And I think we have to think about the world, and I don't think we think enough about the world like this, as there being this other sower who's throwing this counterfeit false seed everywhere he goes. There's so much falsehood, so much deception, so many lies, so much confusion. this is what that other enemy is doing. He traffics in this. So we have these competing sowers, and thank the Lord that this enemy cannot uproot us. I am so glad for that. I am so glad that no one can pluck a believer out of Jesus' hands. So we have this situation where there's this other enemy and he is powerless to uproot us. If I had to summarize these three parables, and I hope you can see that they're a unit, I would summarize them in one line. Be patient, trusting God to deal with evil, and don't despise what is small. Okay, there's the one-line summary of these three parables here. Be patient, trusting God to deal with evil, and don't despise what is small. Okay, so how can we take this and apply this to our world today? Because it's not easy. It's very, very difficult. I read a lot of news because I work in the investing world, and I read this story that came up in Bloomberg. Bloomberg is one of the financial news publications. This story came out April 16th, 2025. It popped up on my terminal, on my computer, and I read it. And let's think about how to respond to this. From the air, the Liberian Agriculture Company rubber plantation spreads like a green carpet over an area twice the size of Chicago. On the ground, more than 4,000 workers toil amid rows of trees, cutting bark, tapping in spigots, and collecting the latex that drips into cups and ultimately will be turned into tires in Europe and the U.S. It's grueling work, especially in West Africa's heat and humidity, and it pays only $5.50 a day. That's for those lucky workers. That's for those lucky enough to get a full-time job. Contract workers, many of them women, are paid even less, and they face repeated demands from supervisors for sex. I said, no. This is a quote. Quote, I said, no, I don't want you because I have my husband, said a rubber tapper named Rebecca, wriggling uncomfortably in a chair at a guest house in Buchanan, a three-hour drive from the plantation. Tiny crosses dangle from her ears as she shakes her head, describing the humiliation involved in securing a day's work. He told me this, since you not agree, I will not assign you. Rebecca, who asked to be identified by a pseudonym to avoid retribution, said the requests for sex are incessant. Seven other women who work at plantations in Liberia and Ghana, owned by the same company, Luxembourg-based Sockfin Group, told similar stories to Bloomberg News during visits in November. Most of them asked that their real names not be used, but eight more people, including a retired school teacher and community advocates, spoke on the record about hearing directly from women who said they were able to work only in exchange for sex. I read this story in April when it came out, and it made me so mad. It made me just furious, and I was fuming there at my desk. How do we deal with this? Again, this is where we're collided. There's a collision, right, where we have this expectation for what's right, for justice, and you read this, and your heart just breaks. Now, I said, be patient, trust God to deal with evil, and don't despise what is small. However, that doesn't mean we're supposed to do nothing. And this is where, again, the context of Matthew is so important. This third speech of Jesus follows the second speech of Jesus. And what was that second speech of Jesus again? Evangelism. Yeah, it was evangelism and going out into the world to save the world. And it is easy to just kind of like be a recluse and put your head in the sand and not deal with these things. But Jesus is not saying that. We have to read this in context. He is saying what is going to happen is that there will be suffering and there also will be transformation. And this is where, if we hold up that little leaven analogy, he says there will and there can be transformation as you disciples go through the world. And I think we've seen this in many parts of the world as good Christians have done good work. So we can maybe add another line. Be patient, trusting God to do evil. Don't despise what is small. Doing the work that Jesus has called us to do in Matthew 10, this sermon of commissioning, the sermon of evangelism, the sermon of witness. That is the faithful response here in order to integrate all this together. If you do that, if the disciples do that, if we are faithful to do that, then, wow. And I want you to think about this for a moment. This is kind of an inspiring thought. Imagine talking to the disciples in this moment. John the Baptist is in prison. He's about to be beheaded. And you went to them and you said, hey, guess what, guys? In 300 years, Christianity will be the religion of the empire. They would say, no way, no way. I can't possibly believe that. I'm telling you it's true, guys. Believe it. The pagan gods are going to fall. No way. We're just like 12 people who nobody cares about. But this is exactly what Jesus is saying. Be patient, trusting God to deal with evil, and don't despise what is small. But what's the second line? What did I say there contextually? What? Yeah, don't despise what's small, but then there's something we're supposed to be doing along the way. Yeah, particularly that work in Matthew 10. That's that transforming leaven that is going to change the world. So the final line here is, or my final point, is that Jesus promises final vindication for those who are patiently trusting and obeying. Okay, look at verse 43. This is the last verse I'll look at. So verse 43 is, I think, pretty compelling. Verse 43, he says, then the righteous will shine forth as the sun in the kingdom of their Father. He who has ears to hear, let him hear. So there is this moment. This is, by the way, drawing from the book of Daniel. Some of you know this reference. It's from Daniel 12:3, where Daniel says that the righteous will shine like the sun. And this very language is used in Matthew chapter 17, verse 2, where it says, Jesus' face shines like the sun. Fascinating. There's a little bit of a look forward here that's happening. And so what Jesus is saying is, for those who are doing what I said in Matthew 10, of course, living by the Sermon on the Mount, living forth this life of the sermon of commissioning or the sermon of evangelism, I'm preparing you with these seven parables, but guess what? If you're faithful, if you trust and obey to the end, you're going to be vindicated, and your face is going to shine like the sun, because you will share in my glory.